Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusofLexington.com. Did you know that half of America is single? Hollywood has never produced anything like this before. The Dating Project, a groundbreaking documentary that follows five single people, ages 18 to 40, as they search for authentic and meaningful relationships. There is no script. There are no actors. These are real people trying to find love and happiness in an age of swiping left or right. From Empower Pictures, Paulus Productions, Family Theater Productions, and PureFlix, you can now own The Dating Project. Save the date by visiting thedatingprojectmovie.com and go a step further and help others in your circle date differently by partnering with Ascension Press. Visit shop.ascensionpress.com to acquire the companion study guide. The Dating Project Movie is now available on DVD and digital download on Amazon, iTunes, and Walmart. Please visit thedatingprojectmovie.com for details.
Welcome to Misfit Faith, where anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Misfit Faith Podcast. I am Jason Stillman, your host. Our number is 949-354-2483. If you've got a question, you got something you want me to discuss, if you want some clarification on something I may have said in the past, give me a call, leave me a voicemail, and I will eventually get around to playing it on the show. Just a reminder, patreon.com/Jason Stillman is where you can go and find my Patreon page and find various ways to support me and the work that I do here on the podcast and elsewhere. Also, our Misfit Faith community, which is the private group on Facebook that all $10 patrons are admitted into. We just finished going through Brian McLaren's book, The Great Spiritual Migration. And we had several weeks, 8 or so, 10 weeks maybe, going through that book. It was really great. And the video courses, the video live chats that I put on Facebook for the members of the Misfit Faith community, I also take those and I make them available for purchase as a kind of single a la carte item. And so eventually, sometime in the coming week, if you go to my website, jasonstillman.com/shop, you'll find the Brian McLaren Great Spiritual Migration video course for sale. It's going to be probably $25, and you're going to get easily 10 hours worth of video of me going through with the community this book and discussing the various themes in it. So I would encourage you, if you've been thinking about the Misfit Faith community and you think it might be something that would be beneficial or helpful for you, but you're not sure, well, for $25, you can purchase any of the courses that we've done in the Misfit Faith community, watch them on your own time, and decide if joining the community is something that you'd want to do. All right, enough of that. Let's get on with it. All right, we are continuing our series here on the Misfit Faith Show called Vatican, Catholicism Without All the Uplifting Parts. This is week 7, and the theme of today's little reflection is the absurdity of the cross. Now, just a bit of a recap concerning what we have learned so far, what we've seen so far in this series. We've talked about the fact that all humans feel a kind of innate lack, a void within ourselves. Now, going back to the Garden of Eden, the serpent in the garden suggested to Eve, and evangelicalism, incidentally, echoes this sentiment quite well, that this sense of emptiness and incompleteness is not natural but foreign, okay? And it must be gotten rid of. It must be overcome by jumping through some set of hoops, right? So eat this apple, right? And you'll be like God. Or pray this prayer, and you'll get that sense of wholeness and completeness. Sign here, come forward, whatever it may be. Now, we saw as well that the crucifixion of Christ effectively put to death the old system, right? According to which God is an idol who, you know, will bestow completeness and well-being upon us, right? Jesus, in his death, nailed those false hopes to the cross. And then last time we considered the leap of faith that we need in order to allow our former gods, our former idols, our false expectations to die and to remain dead, to remain in the tomb for as long as it takes for them to reemerge in expressions that are healthier and more conducive to mercy, humanity, and love. Now, at this point, it seems appropriate to talk a bit more about the death of Jesus, and more specifically, what is called atonement theory. Atonement refers to the death of Christ, and there have been many theories that have been put forth throughout the centuries to explain this seemingly horrific event. Now, the reigning evangelical position is that Jesus died in order to pay the penalty for mankind's sin. Okay, so in this view, God the Father vented his anger upon his own Son and punished him in our place so that he could then show mercy to us. Now, you might be hearing this and thinking to yourself, what do you mean this is one of, if not the reigning position? Isn't this just what the Bible teaches? Well, many evangelicals are unaware of the fact that there are objections to this position that I'm outlining, and there are alternatives to it. Now, according to this position, the reason Jesus needed to suffer at the hands of his Father is due to the holiness and the unbending justice of God. Okay, so since God's righteous character is expressed in his law, and since we have broken this law, God has no choice but to exact his retributive vengeance on someone. Right. And so you often hear when the gospel is presented things like this, you know, God's law is not arbitrary. God's law is not random. He doesn't have the luxury of just making it easier, of lowering his standards so that, you know, we can do better. No, his law, we hear, is an expression of the inflexible holiness of his very character. And so God simply cannot lower his standards. Okay? And so because of this, God has no choice, once his law has been violated by humanity, he has no choice but to find some object of his fury, of his anger. He needs some wrath-quenching substitute, a propitiation, right? Upon whom he can exact his retributive vengeance. Okay? And so Jesus steps in as a sinless substitute. And because of that, God has now gotten his pound of flesh by punishing his Son, and he's now free to extend grace to sinful humanity. Now, there are many problems with this position. The one that I'd like to highlight now is somewhat uncommon and seldom stated, but here goes. I would suggest that the position that I just described fails to truly convey the cataclysmic shift from law to grace, from the old covenant to the new. You know, in John 4, you know, where Jesus talks to the woman at the well about how the hour is coming and is now here when you'll neither in this mountain in Samaria or in Jerusalem worship the Father, but God is spirit and he wants those to worship him in spirit and in truth, right? This idea that with the coming of the kingdom dawns, everything shifts, the locus, you know, of worship ceases to be some geographical location in a temple somewhere, but it becomes something else. You know, you read Hebrews 8, you read Hebrews 10. An argument can be made that the entire book of Revelation, which is often you know, applied to current events that are going to transpire in the last days before the rapture and the second coming and all this kind of crazy left behind stuff. Well, an argument can be made that the whole book of Revelation is simply John, who wrote it, saying in apocalyptic language the same thing he recorded Jesus as having said to the woman at the well in John 4, right? That the old covenant, the old way, is passing away. And it is dramatically, in a kind of microcosmic way, illustrated in the destruction of the Jewish temple in 70 AD, right? And it describes a spiritual phenomenon according to which the old dies and the new comes, right? The old way is put to death and a new covenant emerges with Christ from the tomb on Easter morning. And so this position that I have been describing, that is the evangelical reigning position in the American church at least, it's not giving enough attention to this cataclysmic shift from law to grace, from the old covenant to the new. And in fact, as I'll try to illustrate in just a moment, it's actually a doubling down on the forensic and legal arrangement of the old economy of Moses. You see, by the evangelicals' insistence that God is only able to bestow grace if he first satisfies the bloodthirsty demands of a legal covenant, what he's implying by saying that is that there's some higher authority than God, namely the law, right? And so the law, as it were, has power over God, and it hamstrings his efforts at mercy until, you know, once its standards are met, it finally can give the go-ahead, the thumbs up. It can greenlight the gospel. And so, in other words, according to this mentality, it's really law and not grace that gets the final word, right? Because until the law's demands are met, God cannot be gracious. Now, a couple of brief thoughts by way of response, okay? First of all, you know, perhaps the various efforts to explain the crucifixion, you know, and the disagreements among proponents of the various views, maybe these are themselves proof that the crucifixion has no easy explanation. And so I'm not necessarily rejecting one theory of the atonement and trying to supply another one. I'm wondering out loud whether it's the kind of thing that can be explained at all. You know, Paul referred to the cross of Christ as a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. And so maybe the best and most humble posture to strike toward this mystery is to let it be a mystery. To let it be confusing and seemingly absurd, right? I mean, after all, if, as I've been arguing, there is a void and a sense of meaninglessness at the very heart of life itself, then Jesus' cry of dereliction, my God, why have you forsaken me, at his seemingly senseless death, is itself a perfect example of his participation in the emptiness and the ambiguity that is the human experience. And secondly, the idea that God is somehow unable to simply forgive sinners, full stop, without, you know, getting legal authorization first, is silly. It's silly to say that God can't do that, that God does not have the luxury to simply forgive without getting some sort of propitiation, right? Without finding some innocent object upon which to vent his fury. Who says he can't? Who says God can't simply forgive, full stop? Why not? You know, if my son, you know, does a poor job of cleaning his room, despite his best efforts, you know, he's 11, so he's trying, he didn't do a very good job, but he did his best. I, as his father, can just say, you know what, it's fine, buddy, don't worry about it, good enough, you can go play now. I don't have to find some other child, you know, some stranger's child to step in and clean the room perfectly, you know, every spot of dust, every toy, every Lego put away absolutely perfectly. And then when the other kid has stepped in for my son and cleaned the room perfectly, then I spank that kid because I'm pissed off that my kid did a crap job, right? And then and only then can I let my son go outside and play. No, that's ridiculous, right? I can just decide to accept the imperfect job my son did as good enough if I feel like it, right? I mean, after all, who cares? right? I mean, I love my kid. That's what really matters. Well, to use the logic of Jesus, if I, as an earthly father, can show grace to my son, regardless of his performance, then how much more will God show mercy to his children? And so when we're confronted with the seemingly random and arbitrary nature of life, therefore, and we find ourselves staring into the void, we can remember that Jesus faced the senseless violence and injustice of this world as well. And rather than standing his ground or saying, you know, don't tread on me, he suffered willingly in order to break the cycle of escalatory violence and show humanity a better way. Now, as you know, sometimes on the show, I like to provide sort of snippets of other thinkers, other philosophers, theologians, people that I've been reading and challenged by who are saying something similar to me, but perhaps in a different way or from a different angle. Well, about a year or so ago, I was at a lecture that Pete Rollins gave here in the Seattle area, and he touched upon some of these same themes. And so this is about 7 or so minutes long, maybe 8 minutes. Here you go. Enjoy. This is Pete Rollins talking about Christianity and the absurd.
But our Christianity has often been this idea of the pleasure principle. God is this object that will fix us, make us whole, make us complete, give us the answers. The Bible will give us all of that, right? But I want to argue, no. Christianity is not a religion of the pleasure principle. It's not a religion of the reality principle. It is, in Kierkegaard's words, the religion of the absurd. Right? Tertullian once said, I believe in the crucifixion of the Son of God because it is absurd. Right? So, now, one of the things that everybody agrees with almost is that that's completely rubbish, right? On one side, there are people who go, Christianity is absurd, and that's why you shouldn't believe. And at the other end, there are people who say, Christianity is not absurd, and that's why you should believe. But very few people are saying Christianity is absurd and that's the reason to believe, right? That's the weird one, right? Why would you believe in, that's like saying, you know, I believe in square triangles, and then someone says, well, that's absurd. You go, exactly, that's why I believe in it. Like, that's bizarre. That is not a reason to believe something because it's absurd. That's a reason not to believe something. But the absurd has a very precise definition. Camus, I think, said it very clearly. The absurd is the experience of living in the world where we live between what we want and what we are, and who we'd like to be, between having to act and not knowing how to act. That was Camus' one, the third one, really, is that you live in a world where you have to act, but you don't know how to act. That's absurd. It's absurd because it doesn't make sense. You can't get the answers. You live with anxiety. That's the absurd. The absurd basically defines our human predicament, the human predicament of being in the in-between that I've expressed this morning. That's the absurd, living in the in-between. What has all this got to do with Christianity? The story of Adam and Eve, the very first story in the Bible, I think articulates everything we've been talking about here. If I have anything to contribute to theology, it's this reading of the Adam and Eve, right? Adam and Eve can be read as a Jewish Oedipal story. Remember I said Oedipus wants to sleep with his mother, the father is in the way, he breaks through, sleeps with the mother, thinks it's going to be wonderful, but it's a curse. Right? That is the pleasure principle, the pleasure, the object, the mother he wants. The reality principle is in the way. He thinks if he breaks through reality, it'll be wonderful. He breaks through the reality principle, it's terrible. Well, it's structurally very similar to the story of Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve are walking around the garden. They then have this prohibition. Bam, you can't eat of that fruit of that tree. Right? Go, whoa, that's the prohibition. Then they have this serpent that has a voice that says, what did God really say? Like, if you eat of that fruit, you will become like God, right? What does to become like God mean? Well, that means to lack the lack. That means to be whole and complete, because God traditionally is the one who lacks the lack, the one who is whole and complete. So the voice, you shall be like God, is saying, you eat that piece of fruit and you will be whole and complete, right? You'll be like God, right? Adam and Eve break through the prohibition, the reality principle. They embrace the piece of fruit. They think it's going to be a blessing, but it's a curse. That's the creation story of psychoanalysis. The child, separated from the primary caregiver, wants to return to that. But if they return to it, it would be a disaster. But of course, the other side is if you don't break through reality principle, you're depressed. Oh, you know, I could be a rock star, but look at this. I'm, you know, stuck in this dead-end job. You've got reality principle, but you're imagining something wonderful you could have had. So we're in this dilemma. The Garden of Eden captures that beautifully. It I say, existentially captures the human condition very powerfully. And it has an additional element that's very important. And it's the serpent. The serpent is this voice that says, you can be whole and complete if only you have that. If only you have that. In psychoanalysis, that's called the superego. The superego is the voice that's inside you but is not you, that says you have to do X, Y, and Z and then you'll be good. But what if I stop and I accept this grace, this offensive thing called grace, which basically is the exorcism of this inner voice, is telling our society, or telling us, our community, that we have to be perfect. If only we do this, we'll be perfect. If only X, Y, and Z, right? Then nothing will change. It'll be terrible. But actually, it's grace that allows for change. That was the example I was using before. Like, an AA is a perfect example. In AA, the first thing you have to do is just be honest with yourself. There's no 12 steps. Forget the 12 steps. The first thing you do in AA is simply acknowledge who you are and what you're doing. Oh, my name is Pete and I'm an alcoholic. Right? That's, you're getting the false narrative you tell yourself about yourself. I'm not an alcoholic. I could give up any time I want. It's not a problem. And you're making it fit with reality. You're being honest in a community of grace that accepts you for who you are. And you can sit there for months and not say anything. You just go around and you can just skip, just skip, just skip. But eventually you'll say your name. You'll say you're an alcoholic. And nobody will judge you. Nobody will tell you to change. Nobody will do any of that. Generally, people will just go, yep, I know how you feel. And that's grace. The acceptance that you're accepted. Oh, and by the way, that's the two parts. You can have grace, but you don't accept it. You can be accepted by a community, but not accept the acceptance. Right? It might take years. It might take years of going to AA before you can accept the acceptance. Right? But there might be a point in your life when you begin to accept the acceptance, that you're okay, or you're not okay, and that's okay. You're there in that room. Then you've got 12 steps. Then you've got, oh, here's some practical stuff that might help, that we found useful over time, that you can do, and some of it's very hardcore and all of that, from what I know, I've never been, but the 12 steps is not really where the change happens. The change happens in the acceptance that you're accepted, that you realize you don't have to change.
Hey there. So I was listening to the podcast and thinking about my own faith journey and that of my husband's and how we're raising our kids. And I'm wondering if having a faith crisis is normal. Is that something that, even as much as I'm trying to raise my children to have an open mind as far as faith goes and to ask questions and find answers, is it always going to be a crisis of faith at some point for them? Or is there a way to head that off and prevent them from possibly turning from God because of outside sources or because of, you know, internal feelings about the Bible and about the church? So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that and maybe discussion. I don't know. But yeah, thank you for your podcast. Bye.
All right. Thank you so much for the question. Is having a crisis of faith normal? It's a really good question. And I would suggest that yes. Virtually all religious people have them, even if they don't admit it outwardly. And this is one of the sort of dynamics of American Christianity for some reason, is that we so often act as though, you know, we have it all together. We have our act together. We have all of our loose ends tied up nicely. Our I's are dotted. Our T's are crossed. Even though inwardly, you know, we might be experiencing all kinds of doubt, all kinds of turmoil, all kinds of trauma, but we think we're the only ones, right? And so, therefore, since I'm the only one who struggles here, I can't let it be known. And so I have to put up a front, wear a mask, and act as though everything is right, all my ducks are in a row. But of course, what I'm not realizing is everyone else is doing that as well. And so rather than being vulnerable and real with one another and sharing our doubts with one another, our fears, right, our crises, instead we just perpetuate this illusion, this mirage that we all are completely content and all of our questions are answered. Right. But I would suggest that that's not the case. And even those who seem to have it all together don't. And they're just afraid to admit it. Now, I would suggest that it's when you don't think to question your faith that you're perhaps in the most danger. Right. I mean, if there is somebody, contrary to what I just said, if there is somebody who simply has never really had a crisis of faith, doesn't really have any questions, has no doubts, doesn't experience any ambiguity or complexity or fear or questioning whatsoever, I would suggest that that person's in more danger than anyone else. Right. Because you're just simply not thinking hard enough about it. You're not really engaging with the gospel, with the faith, with Jesus. You're not really allowing the complexity of the message to sink in and disrupt, disturb, and decenter you, right? And so I would suggest that these kinds of crises that we have are symptoms of health and not of sickness. Now, you also brought up, you know, your kids. Like, you know, I'm trying to raise my kids on the one hand to be open-minded. On the other hand, though, you know, I don't want them to turn away from God when they're older. Well, again, I would suggest that the last thing we want to create is a dynamic in the home where it's not okay to question, right? I mean, your kids are going to have questions regardless, you know, especially when they hit 10, 11, 12, 13, they're going to have questions, right? It's not something that you can control. They are going to be wondering, you know, did Jonah live inside the belly of a whale for 3 days? Did God slaughter all of humanity except Noah and his family with a worldwide flood? Are these things real? Are these stories true? Am I supposed to take these things seriously? All these kinds of questions are questions that kids are going to eventually have when they reach that age where they just begin to question everything. Okay? And so we want to make them feel like they can come to us with these questions. And so it's not about, you know, rejecting God when you have questions, but it's about finding ways for our faith to express itself in ways that are genuine and authentic and sustainable, okay? Because if our kids are made to feel that any doubts or questions they have are some faithless affront to God, then they're just going to hold on to their beliefs for the sake of pleasing us, you know, pleasing their parents, or maybe for the sake of keeping up appearances, or they'll hold on to their faith simply to avoid hell, right? But none of that is sustainable. None of that is going to work for them over the long haul. The first moment of freedom they get, they're going to walk away from all of it, right? Whether it's at university or the moment they're no longer forced to go to church and they start to actually have some autonomy over their time and their lives and their beliefs, they're going to walk away from all of it because we've created a dynamic according to which they can't ask us questions. They can't come to us with their fears, with their doubts, with the complexity of it all. And so I would say that the way to head off a crisis of faith is to create a culture in the home where doubts are okay. And talking through them is kind of just what healthy families do. Crises of faith are good. And what we want to do is create a way of doing spirituality, a way of being Christian, according to which if some particular belief is no longer working, if it's outdated, if it's irrelevant, if it's turning me into an asshole, then it's okay for me to crucify that idea and just wait around until something emerges from the tomb in its place, which is exactly what we've been talking about in this Vaticant series here on Misfit Faith. So thank you so much for the question. Hope that helps. All right, almost out of time. Before I let you go, however, I do need a minute.
Now it's time for Jason Needs a Minute.
All right, you know that thing of when, like, you get on an airplane and the pilot comes on and he does his spiel about, you know, how long the flight's going to take and what the altitude's going to be and all that? Well, they always give their names. You notice that? Of both the pilot and the co-pilot, right? You ever wonder why they do that? You know, like, because who cares, right? Who cares who you are? Well, I think they do it to put us at ease. And I think that because no matter what their names are, they always follow a similar pattern, right? I mean, you know, welcome on board this United 747. My name is, you know, Buck Lancaster, and my pilot is with me, Steve Chapman, okay? Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome on board. I'm Bill McAllister, your pilot, alongside Andrew Cunningham, you know, who's manning the cockpit with me, right? You see where I'm going with this? Okay, you'll never hear something like, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome on board this Alaska Air 767. I'm your captain, Abdul Mohammed Al-Hadid. And with me is my co-pilot, Guillermo Rodriguez. No, never gonna happen. Okay, you're never gonna get on a plane and hear, hello, everyone. This is your captain, Linda something or other. And here's my co-pilot, DeAndre Jackson. Nope. We're not there yet, folks. Sorry. And until we are, flight academies are going to have to keep handing out fake white-sounding names to their graduates along with their diplomas.
This has been Jason Needs a Minute.
All right, everybody, that is our show. Thank you so much for listening. 949-354-2483. If I said anything on this show that confused, offended, stimulated you, call me, let me know about it. It goes straight to voicemail. I'll play your voicemail on the air. Patreon.com/Jason Stellman is my Patreon page. JasonStellman.com is the website. The remarks that I gave here on the show are on the website in the form of my most recent blog post. So go to the blog tab. You can read it there. And if something I said didn't quite make sense, you can go look it over again. And if you got any questions, give me a call. But thanks for listening, everybody. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.